ask ourselves the hard questions, you know.
Exactly. Well, I think we're all like a worn musical instrument. I think like a cello that it's been worn and played many, many years, for some of us longer than others. And hopefully we get more mellow and more, we show more shared warmth. Mm-hmm. And out of that comes the love we need. So.
Hello, this is Clay Boykin, and I am in search of the new compassionate male. Today, Dennis Tardon and I had the opportunity to have a wonderful conversation with a dear friend of mine, Art Carter. Here's that conversation.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and I am here with my dear friend, Clay Boykin. Clay?
Hi, Dennis. It's good to be here.
We are both, all of us are in search with Clay, in search of the new compassionate male. Today, we get an opportunity to have Art Carter. Welcome, Art, to the conversation.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, you know, I want to ground us all in history. So I am 72 years old. Am I the elder in this group?
No, I am, I think.
How old are you? How old are
76.
You? 76. You're 76. And Clay?
Yeah.
I'm 66.
All right. So we all grew up in the United States of America during this time, during all of our lives, correct?
That's, yeah, overlapped. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. And it feels that something has changed in the United States, that we are now talking about issues of race in ways that we've not talked about them over the course of our lives. That's what it feels like to me. So as our elder brother on this conversation, Art, one of the things that I would like to do is to know about your experience as you were growing up through the civil rights movements, through that. What was the consciousness, your consciousness as it was evolving, your awareness, your understanding? Because when we're a fish in the ocean, it's very hard to perceive that there is water. When there is just this, when it's just within the culture. So having your experience would help to ground me.
Well, I think my first exposure that I was aware of to the idea of civil rights was grade school, when we lived in York, Pennsylvania, which is in the Pennsylvania Dutch area of the state, southeast, Lancaster, York, Gettysburg kind of area. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand why my parents had to go to the school board to have a meeting about going to elementary school. I mean, I was too young to understand that, but I was aware of it. And it turned out that the historically black elementary school and the one that they wanted me to go to were equal distant. In other words, almost to feet, you could walk them off and they would be in the same area. So I did not realize they had to go and ask for permission to send me to a central elementary school versus Smallwood, which is the same school my dad went to in the 1930s. That was a big decision. And I realize now when I reflect on it, and I went to a reunion, the 50-year reunion some years ago of the elementary school, that it had a real impact on my life because of the five other African-American children, and I know their names, that went to school with me. We were not, you know, a cohort. I mean, we didn't think of ourselves as that. But all five of those folks have PhDs and have made some effort to be leaders in their fields in 2000. And I haven't kept in touch with some of them since 2017, probably 15, 17. So that was my first exposure. The decision to push to go to a grade school that was all white, mm-hmm. all white teachers. But I remember it as a very loving and caring place.
Mm.
That's my memory of Central. And at that 50th reunion, going back there, in fact, it was probably 60th reunion now to think about it, meeting two of the teachers, one of which died within a few weeks after I went to the reunion. I felt like family there.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty good.
Did you have an awareness, Art, that the situation in the South was different? Was there dinner table conversation? What was the dinner table conversation about? What year were you in the first grade?
That would have been, 44, 5, 49, 6. It would have been 1950.
All right.
51, so somewhere there.
Truman had just integrated the military. Mm-hmm. So that was the first time that was happening. So I'm trying to get some kind of an understanding of what the dinner table conversation.
Well, I remember it was political in the sense that I had a large I like Ike button that was huge from a kid. And I wore that to school very proudly, thinking that Ike was my vision of a sort of a granddad. And Eisenhower was important to me, and watching Mamie on television. We didn't have TV, but my neighbor did. And that, I think, was the beginning of a political awareness, too, of what did he stand for, that he was someone you could trust as a leader for the country.
Mm.
And then, of course, I remember all the election people that I was always curious about, like Adlai Stevenson was someone I really admired, and I don't know why. I mean, I remember him sitting with his leg crossed and you could see a hole in his bottom of his shoe. And I thought, well, he can't be all that powerful and smart, which he was, an intellectual, because he has a hole in his shoe. It was a large one, too.
Did you go to an integrated school in Texas? And then when you went to Texas A&M,
yeah,
it was already integrated at that time.
Yeah, so I was in College Station, Texas, and we were not integrated until I believe I went into the sixth grade, which was about 65.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the reason we integrated at that point was that Lincoln School during the summer burned down, and that was the black school. And so just common sense, everybody's got to go to school. And so we were brought together. And I think it was because we were brought together like that, nobody gave it really much of a thought. And I don't recall, I just recall it being, okay, this is what we're doing.
This is, I grew up in Victoria, Texas, which is south central. And we integrated early in the sense that, for a lot of reasons, but it was in 1960, they integrated the schools. And in elementary school and in junior high and high school. However, I remember Jim Crow in the mm-hmm. South. So I remember seeing from the white side the colored entrances to the movie theaters, the separate water fountains, seeing as I've told you, Clay, as riding the Trailways bus to Houston, and then getting off the bus and there being separate waiting rooms. So this is what we're going. So this impacted me in way, even though my mother was an artist and an actor, and we had a very liberal consciousness about what we were saying about people, about equality. I did not realize that the racial bias that I swam in had permeated into my unconscious, was in there. And it only has been in the past, few years, and certainly the past month and month and a half, that I have really had to face that in ways that I have never had to face before. Have you had that experience, Clay?
Yes. Our family doctor, we all loved. Wonderful family. His son and I were buddies. I remember as a young child going into the doctor's office, thought nothing of it. And one day I went all the way down the hall and realized that there was a back entrance. And that was the colored entrance. And that really struck me at the time, because it was so counter to what my perception was. So it was absolutely present, but I was unaware of it.
Right.
Well, we were fortunate in that my dad's doctor, who was served him when he was younger, he was African American. He was still our family doctor until I got to maybe mid-grade school, toward the end of grade school. And then we got another family doctor who was the brother of my homeroom teacher in middle school. And we loved him. He was a white fella, but he was a very good doctor. And having his brother as my homeroom teacher, I just felt it was like a family feeling. Mm-hmm. And that was good. The first real racial separation issue I remember back then was pretty much not, well, I knew in middle school, we called them junior high schools in those days.
Right.
In junior high school, that I was going to the only really mixed middle school, because in the city, the other two junior high schools were 99% white. Mm-hmm. I think one was 100% white, and the other one might have had a smattering of African American kids. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, my play brother, that's someone I grew up with since I was 6 months old. Mm. I still consider him my brother. We don't call play brother, but, you know, he's my brother. I've known him for 76 years. We wanted to join the YMCA to go swimming, because the city had closed the pools, municipal pools, to keep out integrated pools. That would have been maybe 1956, somewhere around there, 56, 57. But we weren't able to do that initially. And it was one of our, again, a teacher to the rescue, middle school teachers that said that my brother was a good guy. He knew him much better than I did, and that he should be allowed to join the YMCA. And when that door opened, both of us went in. And that was a remarkable thing, because Ron had serious asthma, and the water was a healing agent, helped him overcome his asthma. And so we would swim, and in those days you didn't have to, you know, it was all, you didn't even wear swimsuits. Ron got better and better because he had a real purpose in the water, and I just flailed away and got some swimming out of it. But from that time on, he became so good of a swimmer, he became a diving coach.
Wow.
And has coached three Olympic diving teams in the U.S. And but he was not allowed, once we joined the Y, to be in the water by himself. I mean, with other white kids. He had to swim separately.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And finally, the coach, who I remember him, my high school teacher, was named Schmidt, said, well, that boy should be able to get in the water with the white kids. And he was admonished for saying that. But we were in around the pool, and one of the white kids was flailing away, and Ron jumped in the pool and helped saved him. And from that effort, we were allowed to swim with the white kids.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting that you're talking about the pool, because this is bringing up memories in my mind. And we had separate swimming times.
Uh-huh.
I had totally forgotten that.
Isn't that amazing?
And that was on the Texas A&M campus.
Yeah.
Okay. It was a college back then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You graduated in high school at what time? What year, Art?
1961.
61. I did 66. Clay?
72.
72. Okay. Now, so what was your awareness, understanding of where the civil rights movement was? Was there any talk about it? Any talk about your cohort about what was going on in the South? Why was it different? How was it?
No, we didn't have, I don't remember any family conversations. My dad and mom were both voracious readers, but I don't remember ever having any conversations about that until college. I don't think I had any feelings. I remember in college when Dr. King came and spoke, how exciting that was to see him live. And he gave a very famous address at that time. That was back at Penn State in 1963.
Wow.
And, of course, I was just, wow, Dr. King. At the same time, I had quite a political awareness because I was a real JFK fan.
Mm.
And, my mother was an active neighborhood support person for the Democratic Party. And she got the title of being a committee person, state committee woman. And so politicians would come in and out of the house, and they usually dropped off money. So it could be used to get people to the polls. That was one of the that was important in our neighborhood. If you were going to, you had to get money for taxi or money to do whatever you wanted with it. But that $10 or $5 was a big deal in those days. And so she would end up with this big wad of money, which was to be given out in the neighborhood and get people to vote.
Yep.
And the party worked that way very well. And as I got older and in college, on my vacation time or when time off, I would do some volunteer work. And then one of the jobs was to collect that money from people who had state jobs. You know, you would go door to door, well, call them first, and pick up their contribution back to the party.
Mm.
And we had rosters of all the state employees that lived in our community. And they would all chip in some donation. It wasn't a donation, but you had to pay.
Mm-hmm.
That was the party during that time.
Yes.
So you're graduating. You're graduating from college, and this, and so I'm were you aware? And so what was your consciousness about the change that needed to be made and the changes that needed to be implemented as a society when you were graduating from college? Was there an arc in your consciousness art that you could?
Well, it's very personal. I didn't have a sense of a national movement or agenda. I just remember graduating and wanting. I didn't want to live at home, mm-hmm. So I lived at home. I think maybe 6 months or something, you know. And you wanted to be on your own. You had your bachelor degree. You thought you had achieved something. And I remember looking for my first apartment in York, Pennsylvania. And I didn't have a car or anything, but I had access to an aunt's car. And looked up, Clay, I might have shared this with you. I looked up an apartment was available. Oh, yeah. And at that time, I was a school teacher. I had my first job as a school counselor. And I was the first counselor in the elementary schools of York. They never had elementary counselors. And I thought, well, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to be an advocate for the kid and the parents in relationship to the school, because it was clear the school was very unfriendly and hostile to parents. Mm-hmm. This was my first encounter with additional prejudice. I called up an ad in the local paper, and I thought, can I afford the apartment? And I called the lady, and she said, well, it was a school teacher living in this apartment, and she's moving back to Arles, France, which was our York sister city. I knew about Arles. And I thought, well, if she could afford it, then it's going to be in my budget. I'll go look at it. I drive over to Philadelphia Street, which is one of the main streets in York. And the woman standing on the stoop out front on the porch. And I said, oh, hi, I'm Arthur. I didn't use Arthur. I think I used Wesley as my middle name. I said, I'm Wesley Carter. I just talked to you about the apartment. And she said, with her arms folded, you didn't sound like a nigger on the telephone. Oh, I couldn't rent to you. Mm. She said, my tenants wouldn't have it. And that was the first experience with housing discrimination. And there was no one to talk to about that or nothing you could do. Of course, I didn't get the apartment. And then looking for other apartments in that same, within the same weeks or months, I got physically assaulted twice by people in York who did not, one man, get off my porch and grab me around the neck to throw me off the porch. And I was a little guy in those days. And you didn't fight back.
What was on the way home from the apartment, from being told that going home from the apartment, do you remember what was going through your head or what was going through your mind as you're going, as you go home from these encounters, as you go, what goes through your mind?
Well, I don't remember, but I know I was a church kid growing up in church. So I think I kept thinking that he was evil. There's something evil about that person. I couldn't put it. I don't even think I thought of it as just prejudice, because mm-hmm. I didn't have a good handle on what prejudice is. But I thought of him as an evil person. Mm-hmm. All of them.
Yeah.
And that was the status quo. That was just the beginning. I got married, I think, within 2 years after that. And we had to sue, get an attorney, even get an apartment in the same community. They were, it was closed off to African Americans, period. Eventually, in that same community, we were able to buy a house. Well, not in the same community, but nearby in the county. And was quite happy about it.
You know, with so much of, so I want to fast forward here because there's so much to talk about. And I want to fast forward to the Roberts ruling on voting rights a few years ago that nullified the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that said, he said, racism is over. We've had an African-American president. There is no more racism. So all of the reasons why we would have the states to have to qualify in order to make sure that things are fair, that it's over with. Obviously not, but that stunned me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I carry my voter registration card everywhere I go. I mean, it's just along with my license, it's all you have. And I mean, that to me, that's a critical thing to have, that I have a right to vote. And that identifies me as a person that has empowered himself to vote. That just feels very important. And the barriers are real in Texas. I mean, it's actually real. The efforts you have to make to well, I've not had any problems voting since I've only lived here since 2006. And so I have not encountered any barriers to voting. But I know that there are, for instance, extraordinary lines that people are put in that keep them from voting. I know that the state officials are very opposed to expanding mail-in ballots. So I see this in the news, but I've not experienced any of it.
Well, but so much, Art. I mean, I have a birth certificate. I have a passport. Imagine without those things, how would I get the kind of ID?
Yes.
That would allow me just to be able to vote. If that is not, I mean, the extraordinary amount of money of tracking it down, of the resources in order to get that so that I would have the basic ID. What if I didn't drive and I only went on a bus, so that I have to be able to
get
to
there.
The place?
Well, I had an encounter with, it was an exercise 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when I was doing a little substitute teaching here in Austin. Some of the teachers got a hold of actual tests that were used in Alabama for black voters have to pass, I mean, black residents, in order to vote. And no one could pass the test. And it had an escape clause that said that if any one of these questions were wrong, then you fail the whole entire test. And it was up to the registrar in each community to determine if you qualified, if your score was a passing score. So it ultimately went right back to the source of the discrimination to determine if you would be allowed to vote.
How long ago was that?
Oh, 3 years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm. And if the racism...
2 years ago.
But because the racism is rooted into, I mean, it was part of our Constitution. It was part of pre-constitutional times. I mean, this country was built upon this. Mm-hmm. It's really come to my consciousness in the last few months, and just using George Floyd as a marker, certainly not as an only case. This is merely a marker and along. Clay, would you please talk about your experience in these last months or so?
Oh gosh, yeah, it's been a real roller coaster. You know, it was a Monday night, May 25th, and we were having our men's circle. And we're doing it by Zoom. And our topic that night was aspirations. What are your aspirations in life? And we went on and had our evening. I woke up the next morning to learn that as we were in our circle, 25 white men talking about our aspirations, George Floyd was being murdered. And that really hit me, and I went into a tailspin. I think I went into somewhat shock. I was frozen to the TV. This was a defining moment. And then I started realizing I've got a responsibility. I've got a responsibility to the men in our circle, to the network. And here we are coming up on the following Monday, and our circle is a contemplative circle. So we're not bringing in the world issues. We're not trying to solve the world. You know, we're more get our head to heart and learn how to speak from there and to connect and trust one another as men. That's our whole focus. But yet all this is going on. So how do I pay attention to that and not bring it into the circle? I was really conflicted. And I came out of that following Monday feeling very hollow because we danced around. We didn't talk about anything. And I realized then that we were at a defining moment in our men's fellowship network.
And I want to put a pin on and ask one thing on this.
Yeah.
These are 25 white men, not exclusionary, but certainly not, because you have had African-Americans.
Absolutely.
Who have had at different times. Yeah. But what, because this is the thing, to what would have been our responsibility to actively include rather than just passively continue to be?
Yeah, we just made it open, and you know, we have people from different parts of the country. And
a self-selection.
It's a self-selection. I had no, you know, program to say, let's make this the right mix. So, you know, these are men that are all healing from, well, we're all healing, but from something.
Yeah.
But these are men that are not necessarily going to join a men's group in the traditional fashion. You know, these are, well, I'm going to just speak about myself. I grew up not trusting other men. And I got to a point in life where I realized that there's things in life that I can only learn from another man, but I've shut myself off from that. So how do I make that connection, and how do I begin to learn about life? And, you know, we get 25 men in that circle. You know, there's over 1,000 life years of experience right there. You know, and Dennis, when you're there, there's something I can learn from you and you can learn from me. We're not trying to fix anybody. You know, we're not trying to teach anybody, but we're experiencing and sharing where we are in our soul and our life. And we grow that way.
And you've done that for more than 8 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've done it weekly for over 8 years now. And I've got circles, you know, various places in the U.S. I've got a circle in Kenya. And matter of fact, it was about a year ago during this time that I was packing to go over there for that. What a fantastic time that was. But yeah, and, you know, I've got a website. And I'm going to plug it here. It's mensfellowship.net. That website there has got all of our topics of conversation on it. I've got over 400 pages out there. And since day one, when I go back and look at Google Analytics, literally half of the people that visit that website are women. Literally half. It's always been that way. And it's been the same on my website, clayboykin.com. It's very interesting. So I've been focused on gender equity. And I've been working in that program with some fantastic folks with Gender Equity and Reconciliation International. I've 28 years doing this, deep healing between women and men, realizing that the patriarchy has wounded us both. Let's find that as our common ground and learn to know each other in a different way.
Absolutely.
So I've been working on that the past year and a half, and it's really been a growing and a stretching. I'm, you know, my growing edge, as they call it. And I've really been out there. But then here May comes and what happens to George Floyd. And now the race question is right in front of me. And I realize that I'm a privileged white male. And there's a book called Me and White Supremacy. You know, it was handed to me. You know, well, I'm not a white supremacist. You know, and I bolted at that, knee-jerked at that. But, you know, as I settle back and get over the emotion of it and look at what's in that book, I check mark off and say, yeah, my actions, not intentional. And I don't see it. You know, I'm, like you said earlier, I'm the fish in water asking, well, what is racism? And so, yeah, it's this is a real defining time. It's a real shifting time. And as a result, to wrap up, as a result of those 2 weeks, I started a second men's circle. And that men's circle is In Search of the New Compassionate Male, Racism in America. And we're peeling that onion back. And there's a small group of us. And that is a group. Those are discussions. And it is a very vulnerable time to figure this out and work together. And Art, I'm grateful that you're participating in it.
I'm just thinking that this is a defining time when you use that term. More than we know,
yeah,
it's not an accident that the virus or viruses, because there are more to come, and racism and economic decay, they're all tied together.
Yeah,
I think Mother Earth is rebelling spiritually and physically to the treatment provided by humankind.
Mm-hmm.
To each other, to our brethren all over the globe, the destruction of the rainforest and the Amazon, yeah. All this is done by human greed, racism towards the native peoples of Brazil. When I was in Brazil, the racism was very clear, that a white anglicized Brazilians or Europeanized Brazilians control everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I think our earth is in this, it's all interrelated somehow.
Oh, yeah.
And we have got to get to grips, come to grips with this.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I'm asking psychologically. Because Clay, one of the things that I love about what you're doing is that you're talking about the rising In Search of the New Compassionate Male as a new archetype.
Yes.
That it's a way for us to be that is different from the way that we had. I know that when I was growing up, there was I would look out at men and I would go, well, I'm certainly not like that, what the stereotype of what a white man is. That didn't feel like me. I didn't feel like my inside. And we're getting a chance to so this new archetype, mm-hmm, is, can you talk a little about that, about what you're searching for and the kinds of things that you're discovering there?
Sure. You know, if I go back and, you know, I guess Carl Jung and his conversations and his studies and talk about archetypes, and then Robert Moore and Douglas Gillette, I believe, with the king, warrior, magician, lover, and that conversation about those archetypes and men growing and understanding what those different archetypes are, and that's, well, I'm a king, well, I'm a warrior. Well, they're really kind of a hybrid. We're all, you know, an archetype is not one person. But what I am witnessing and what I'm finding in my travels across the U.S., and I found it with the guys I was working with in Kenya, is that underneath the surface, in each and every one of us, there's a burning that's happening. And that burning is truth. Mm. And we know it, but we're pushing it down because of how we're trained and how the, you know, the patriarchy, the whole system. And I believe that that's, you know, the essence of love played out for me, an expression of compassion. And so I believe that within every, you know, king, warrior, magician, lover, that there's a spark of compassion, that's the common theme. And so to rise up and say emerging from those archetypes is the new compassionate male. It doesn't negate any of those. It's a yes and.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see this. Let's define what this is. And that's what I'm looking for. I don't have that answer. And I'm searching for that. And I'm engaging people. Say, what is that? That's what this conversation is. What does that mean?
So art, as an academician and scientist and study that you studied for all your life, and you're so beautifully well read, how does that resonate? Help us with this, and for both you personally and you from the broader knowledge that you have over all the literature, philosophy, and psychology and science that you've experienced.
Well, I think Clay's statement of the concept of a compassionate male is very Jungian, and it really is, it's a fusion of new thought and ancient wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
It's the kinds of things that before the dominance in our global society of male dominance, the mystics spoke to women, and women were spoke often in poetic ways about that in a powerful but loving way, or loving but powerful way. Maybe you can flip that either way.
Yes.
In all of the ancient societies. But it's only, I think, we're just emerging from probably 600 or 700 years of Western male dominance in the world. To the exclusion of ancient Middle Eastern and Far East societies. And so this new compassionate male will be a blend of open to the Eastern thoughts and learn, able to learn from that. And that's very exciting.
Well, there's scripture, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. And, you know, why am I calling it the new compassionate male? Well, some of us are learning this for the first time, so I call it new. And you know something else? This isn't exclusionary with gender either. I don't call it the new compassionate man. I call it the new compassionate male, because that divine male energy is in men and women. Whatever your gender is, we both have that. And so it's relevant for a woman to say, what does the new compassionate male energy within me mean? How do I get my arms around that? How do I point to that? So I said new compassionate male specifically for that reason, to be inclusionary in that sense.
One of the things that I love about the way you framed this, Clay, is that it's in search of, which makes it an active, which means we're all in this. We're here in the process. It's not a done deal.
No.
It is an actual experience of emergence.
Yeah.
And it has to begin from within.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I mean, intellectually, we can understand the changes and look for social change to help social change, but it's an actual inward movement to discover our true souls.
That's right.
As we discover our true souls and allow it to speak to us, we can be more compassionate and feel safe in a current world that is so dispassionate.
And we talked about this the other night was, you know, we've got marches going on, all the protesting and stuff. What am I going to go do? Well, and we're sitting in the circle going within. And that's working at the source. That's not going to speak to this issue right here. It's not going to fix today, but it's going to set the framework for tomorrow. And each one of us, I know me, every time I go into that circle, whether it's on Monday night or especially Wednesday nights now, I come out just a little bit different. So I'm showing up in everything that I do, and my trajectory is just a little bit different. And I can't verbalize it. I can't quantify it, but I'm a different person than I was 8 years ago.
You know, I love how you say that, Clay, because in the work that I'm doing and that I'm doing with each human being that I work, I do my best to make a conscious decision before I enter that conversation to open my head and heart, open my mind and soul so that I exit the conversation at a higher level of vibration than I entered it.
Yeah.
Just without having a goal or an outcome, just a being willing to have, and that's what I see you doing at each time that you have one of the circles.
Yeah.
Each time I interact with you, Art.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, Art. I mean, you're witnessing it. You're seeing us struggling. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a blessing that you're there because it helps us. It helps us really ask ourselves the hard questions, you know.
Exactly.
Well, I think we're all like a worn musical instrument. I think like a cello that it's been worn and played many, many years, for some of us longer than others. And hopefully we get more mellow and we show more shared warmth.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that comes the love we need. So we need to play on and on.
Yeah.
I have if we think of ourselves evolutionarily, this last 600 years is a blink of an eye as to what our species, Homo sapien, and where we are during this time. So it really is an opportunity for us to be able to. And one of the things that I love about the concept of that came out of the University of Pennsylvania, which is positive psychology movement and appreciative inquiry, is for us to be able to make sure that we are recognizing where growth is happening, when in the media it's always going to the most lurid and for us to have this is one of the reasons why I wanted in on this conversation with you, Clay, and with you, Art, is to be able to recognize that this is happening. It is happening in little green shoots around, and it's important for us to nurture them as they do.
Wow. I think of the, positive psychology was really fairly disdained just 25 years ago.
Study what's going right, why people go right. I mean, what a concept.
And our ability to change as humans, but I do think, the spiritual side of us is changing too, and I think it's a driving force. So even though it may not be attached to any church or denomination per se, there is a strong desire to have a spiritual connection, and that we're realizing that coming out of these younger people who are on the protest lines, it's their souls are speaking. It's not just their heads. Their souls are speaking out and crying out for change.
Yeah.
What a wonderful conversation. Clay, is there anything that we haven't talked about from your end that is important for us to share today?
There's mountains we haven't talked about, but we're not.
Well, I know, I know, and then, which is why, if I don't get a chance to talk with you, Art, and you, Clay, again, that would really be a miss for me. So yeah. I'm going to work on that. But Art, is there anything that is on your heart today of the things that are going on in this? And we're at the 1st of July, right before the celebration of another Independence Day in the United States for all that means and doesn't mean. So anything today in 2020 that's on your heart and mind?
Well, I can't get very excited about Independence Day because it doesn't mean much to me. But I think, we can just celebrate the human spirit that is so alive and active, and that we are now able to share with fellow humans in ways that we couldn't have done technologically a few years ago. So let the spirit live and let it be heard. Period.
You know, I want to chime in on that, Art, and I'm glad you said that. And in some of my studies over the past several years, at one point I went back and looked at a very high level at the Vedic texts. And then I looked at the New Thought principles and realized that those are almost identical. And so earlier on when you said New Thought, Ancient Wisdom, that's exactly what it is. And there is nothing new under the sun. We're saying it way back there. And that's the point that you're making about, you know, it's about love, people. Yeah. And for me, yes, it's about love played out with action in terms of compassion for self, for others. Snowmass Conference, all the interfaith traditions, all there, they all agreed on 10 basic premises, 10 things that they have in common. I go and lay that on the Vedic text, the New Thought text. Well, guess what? They almost all line up. So you're right. We're all heading in a common direction. You don't see it on the news, but make no mistake about it. It is happening. It is absolutely happening. So thanks for bringing that up, Art.
Thank you, Art. Thank you, Clay. This is Dennis Tardon, and we will see you next time.